headlines, Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei received the first dose of a domestically made coronavirus vaccine. The UN once again calls for an end to Israeli settlement plans and demolition of Palestinian homes in the occupied territories. Also in the headlines, Russia says Britain and the US try to incite conflict in the Black Sea amid tensions following the presence of a British destroyer off the coast of the Crimean Peninsula. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has received the first dose of a domestically produced COVID vaccine. Ayatollah Khamenei received the first shot of COVID-Iran Barakat vaccine and thanked all those involved in producing it. The leader said that there is nothing wrong with using a foreign vaccine along with the Iranian one. However, he said he preferred to use the Iranian-made shot. COVID-Iran Barakat was unveiled in December of last year. Its mass production began 3 months later. Iran is also working on producing several other vaccines to inoculate its population against the pandemic. The country is among the first nations that started developing coronavirus vaccines. Iran has rejected as highly politicized the Canadian Forensic Team report that accused Tehran of incompetence over a Ukrainian plane crash last year. Iran's deputy foreign minister said, for international and legal affairs said that Canada lacks the authority to conduct a unilateral report on an air crash outside its jurisdiction. Mohsen Bahorvand also rejected as technically unfounded the report's criticism of Iran's investigation into the incident. He said Iran has fulfilled its commitments under international law. The country mistakenly shut down the Ukrainian airliner in January of last year. 176 people were sadly killed. Tehran has reportedly said the incident was the result of human error in a high alert situation. It happened amid tensions with the U.S. over its assassination of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iran's retaliation for his killing. Well, following the U.S.'s seizure of tens of Iranian and regional media websites, including that of Press TV, media activists have questioned the U.S.'s claim of an advocate for freedom of expression. Youssef Jalali has more.
Following the U.S.'s seizure of Press TV and three dozen other Iranian and regional media websites, Press TV has moved to its alternative domain at presstv.ir. While this is not the first time the U.S. has targeted Press TV, it does raise the question of what makes American officials go out on a limb and violate basic principles of free speech to mute Press TV.
And I see a silver lining in all this, and the silver lining is the extent to which Press TV has been successful in its efforts to make the voice of the voiceless heard. And that's what Press TV is all about. And apparently, truth hurts.
Press TV first went on air in 2007 as Iran's only English-language news network. It works based on the motto of the voice of the voiceless and tries to cover stories that mainstream media usually boycott or underreport. A case in point is the Israeli occupation of Palestine. During the latest Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip in May this year, Press TV maintained active presence on the ground to shed light on Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people.
Of course, our responsibility at Press TV was to show the reality on the ground, and I believe that we did that. We covered it well, and we had people on the ground interviewing Palestinians and showing the reality, because a lot of times what the mainstream media like to show is a different version. We were on the ground. The cameras were rolling when they were pulling kids from under the rubble.
And when it comes to the Saudi-led coalition's ongoing war on Yemen, Press TV has enlightened the minds of its viewers about how the U.S. and the U.K. are benefiting from the conflict by selling their arms to Saudi Arabia, only to drop them on Yemeni civilians.
Because I know when I'm in contact with different people around the world, especially other Americans or Europeans, and they didn't even know that the United States was involved in this, in this situation in Yemen. And I think that we have continually tried to expose the truth, showing the U.S. Giving the military support, drone strikes in various areas, and we know overall just supporting the Saudis. So, of course, this is all related. All of this has been related to the situation.
And the list goes on. U.S. police brutality against people of color, its destabilizing military presence in the region, its role in the emergence of Daesh terrorists, and so on. All were exposed in different programs on Press TV. The U.S.'s attempt to stifle Press TV's enlightening voice has a long history. YouTube and Facebook have taken down Press TV's webpages several times in the past. The news network has also been removed from TV broadcasting satellites in Europe, North America, and East Asia, largely due to pressure from the United States and some of its allies. Press TV is among the few independent news outlets that speak the unspoken truths, which in times have debunked the U.S. standing as a role model in the world. So observers say it should come as no surprise that Washington tries to pull the plug on Press TV. But that again proves that free speech is just a slogan there. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The UN says Israel is flagrantly violating international law by expanding settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds. The UN called for an immediate cease to the advancement of all settlement activity. The call was made at a session on the implementation of a 2016 Security Council resolution that declared settlements have no legal validity. During the meeting, UN officials warned that Israeli settlements are a major obstacle to a solution to the decades-long conflict in the occupied territories. The UN called on Israel to end the demolition of Palestinian homes and other property, as well as the displacement of Palestinians. On Thursday, Israel advanced plans for 31 new settlement construction projects in the occupied West Bank. International human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan says UN measures to stop Israel's settlement expansion activity are just limited to resolutions. He says the world body should focus on taking concrete action.
Well, it's cruel. And in fact, in some cases, the Israelis forced the Palestinians to demolish their own homes, which I think is really sick, quite frankly. You have the United Nations has, it's over 60 or 70 resolutions that have been condemning Israel, and Israel just ignores them because there's no substance to them and no concrete action taken. In most cases, when it's before the Security Council, the United States will veto the Security Council resolution. If I recall correctly, Obama did not veto one of the resolutions, and that sort of shook the Israelis a bit, but the Israelis just march on. It's creeping annexation, creeping ethnic cleansing, as they each week they demolish more Palestinian homes, they annex more territory, and they use their policies to basically drive out the non-Jewish and the Palestinian population from the area.
The Yemeni army says it has launched a new drone attack against Saudi Arabia. The army says the latest attack hit King Khalid Air Base in the southwest of Saudi Arabia. It said the strike was conducted precisely and was in response to Saudi-led aggression against Yemen. On Tuesday, Yemen also used 10 drones to hit a command post and training site near the Saudi border. Some 60 people were killed or injured. Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies, backed by Washington, launched a war on Yemen in March of 2015. Tens of thousands of Yemenis have been killed, many of them women and children. Russia has accused Britain and the U.S. of trying to incite conflict in the Black Sea amid rising tensions in the region. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov said Washington and London are sowing strife by refusing to accept that Crimea is part of Russia. He said Moscow will defend its borders by all means, including with its military. Tensions run high following the presence of a British destroyer off the coast of the Crimean Peninsula on Wednesday. Russia said its forces fired warning shots and dropped bombs to deter the vessel, accusing it of entering Russian territorial waters. The UK, however, said the ship was conducting what it called innocent passage through Ukrainian territorial waters. It said the mission was in accordance with international law. Still in Europe, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel says EU leaders have rejected an immediate meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
It was not possible to agree today that we should meet immediately at the top level, but for me it is important that the dialogue format is maintained and that we work on it.
Merkel was speaking with reporters after the first day of talks by EU leaders. She said the talks on how to communicate more closely with Russia were detailed and not easy. Germany and France had proposed a summit with Moscow for what Paris called defending EU interests. However, it was turned down. Poland and Baltic countries said the proposal would send the wrong message as East-West ties deteriorate. Those relations have worsened over a number of issues, including the conflict in Ukraine. U.S. President Joe Biden has approved an emergency declaration in the state of Florida after a 12-story residential building collapsed there. The White House says the declaration authorizes the Department of Homeland Security to coordinate all disaster relief efforts. A 40-year-old tower collapsed in the town of Surfside near Miami on Thursday. One person died as a result. Almost 100 others are still unaccounted for. Search and rescue operations are underway to find possible survivors. There was no immediate word on the cause of the incident. The high-rise was undergoing a recertification process requiring repairs. It had more than 130 units, of which 80 were occupied. Canada has been rocked by news of newly discovered graves at the site of a former residential school. The finds are a reminder of the abuse and suffering of the Indigenous people who are still being discriminated against.
Generations of horrific abuse of Indigenous people in Canada once again under the spotlight. A First Nations group in Saskatchewan province has revealed that the remains of hundreds of people, mostly children, were discovered at the site of a former Catholic boarding school there. Local Indigenous leaders want an inquiry into what they call genocide. The First Nations group said that the church that ran the residential school removed the headstones. The piece of tragic news came just weeks after the discovery of the remains of over 200 Indigenous children rattled the country. The latest finds have reopened old wounds in Canada about the notorious residential schools mostly operated by the Roman Catholic Church for the government of Canada. During the 19th and 20th centuries, 130 boarding schools forcibly separated more than 150,000 Indigenous children from their families. The program was aimed at assimilating Indigenous youth, but the schools subjected them to malnutrition and physical and sexual abuse. An estimated 6,000 First Nation kids died while attending these schools. Under mounting pressure, the Canadian government formally apologized for the system in 2008. However, despite growing calls, the Pope and the Roman Catholic Church have refused to apologize.
They're abrogating their responsibilities. By admitting their crimes, they're admitting that they're not following their own teachings. The crimes that they committed are so horrific, and children were beaten for simply speaking their own languages.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said on Thursday that he was terribly saddened by the new discovery. He said the trauma that Indigenous people feel is Canada's responsibility to bear. But has Ottawa really learned a lesson, and is it serious about alleviating the plight of First Nations?
The years between 1863 and 1998 were undoubtedly a traumatic period in Canada's history. Emerging evidence shows the extent of abuse at schools that operated during those years. Members of Canada's Indigenous community who survived that period today still find a decent life a far-fetched wish, that is.
Canada is ranked among the world's seven largest advanced economies. The modern country, with one of the highest GDPs in the world, has long been a popular destination for millions of immigrants from across the globe seeking jobs and a better life. While Canada may sound like a dream world to many, it is far from a utopia for its own indigenous population. Canada's 1.7 million indigenous citizens, nearly 5% of the population, mostly live in isolated communities where poverty, high unemployment, and high rates of suicide are chronic problems.
There are psychological problems that have been passed down from generation to generation. Fathers who were in the generations in the residential schools and mothers suffered severe psychological problems because of the treatment they received. And that's just been passed down from generation to generation. And it's going to take years to correct that.
They have long complained that they are not getting a fair share of incomes from resources on their ancestral lands. Meanwhile, Aboriginal women have been subjected to deadly violence for many years. A national public inquiry concluded a few years ago that about 1,200 Aboriginal women have been murdered or gone missing in Canada since 1980, with activists putting the number much higher. Human rights groups have repeatedly raised the alarm about the situation of Canada's indigenous population. Canada says it is ashamed of systemic racism, discrimination, and injustice that indigenous peoples have faced. In 2017, the Canadian government acknowledged the humiliation, neglect, and abuse of First Nations and pledged to improve their lives. But First Nations are still struggling with a long list of problems and are fighting an uphill battle for their rights.
And that's it with international news.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Enemies of Iran have always opposed elections in the Islamic Republic. This is part of a speech delivered on May 27, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the members of the 11th Parliament. The speech was delivered via video conference with the participation of the Speaker of the Parliament and other members.
In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master and Prophet, Abul Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad, and upon his pure, immaculate, and infallible household, especially the one remaining with Allah on earth. I thank Allah the Exalted for having given us the opportunity to hold this meeting at the end of a full year of continuous activity on the part of you, honorable representatives of the people. Although it would have been sweeter and better if I could see you up close. The circumstances are unfortunately like this, and I have to speak and listen to you from a distance.
Subhanallah, hamdan lillah.
Today I will speak about the parliament and I will also raise some points about the elections. Thankfully, in the year that passed, the parliament showed that it is diligent, determined and competent. The points raised by the Honorable Speaker of the Parliament, Muhammad Baqir Qalibaf, in his eloquent and informative speech really makes one happy. Of course, we have received reports from other places that confirm this. Thankfully, the presence of young and energetic individuals alongside the veteran individuals who have a legislative or executive background has helped this parliament to make good accomplishments, both in the area of ratifying bills on important matters and in the area of showing presence among the people and seeing the realities of their lives. The provincial trips of the Honorable Speaker of the Parliament, the heads of parliamentary commissions, and some honorable members is really a good move, and it should continue, God willing. My dear ones, you should not stop showing your presence among the people. One of the greatest accomplishments is to be able to stand beside the people. Since the formation of this parliament, some people have set themselves the task of portraying a negative picture of the parliament. These people have made certain statements and they continue to do so. They say certain things in various media, which everyone has access to, statements that do not smell of sympathy.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Ministry.
This year, the Zionist Flag March goes beyond just being an annual tradition that settlers have been striving to establish to revive the so-called unification of Jerusalem under the Israeli Occupation Authority after the 1967 war, to represent a vital pit stop in a wide, more complex context. Hence, the Israeli political and security measures that accompanied this march were not of ordinary significance, but rather carry special indicators related to two dimensions, colonial settler security and internal Zionist politics. The first dimension is based on the results of the Battle of the Sword of Al-Quds, while the second reflects the first challenge that Benjamin Netanyahu bet on to test the new government headed by Naftali Bennett. The Israeli occupation's measures reflected the extent to which the messages sent by the Palestinian resistance in the Gaza Strip affected the political and security decision makers in Tel Aviv. However, what the Israeli government headed by Bennett is currently facing is more than a march of flags, but rather the actual future of the government and its stability. You see, the flag march used to pass annually through the old city of Jerusalem to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This time, there was a clear decision not to enter the old city gates at all. Likewise, it appears from the military reinforcements of the occupation that it assigned a soldier to protect every two colonial settlers, as the number of participants in the march reached about 5,000, while the Israeli occupation forces mobilized about 2,500 police to secure it, in addition to the Shin Bet and other security services. Yet, all of this reinforcement did not prevent the outbreak of the most violent confrontations in occupied Al-Quds since the Bab al-Amud eruption last Ramadan. It is clear that Israel and the government of Bennett in particular is on the verge of facing multiple internal political and strategic challenges, Netanyahu will obviously try to exploit all these challenges for personal political gains, and that will only deepen the internal Israeli predicament. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Once again, the occupied West Bank, Al-Quds, and the Gaza Strip borders are turning into a theater of confrontations after a few days of relative calm. As individual operations are back in the forefront again in the occupied territories as a result of, one, the Flag March organized by illegal colonial settlers. The march had already been postponed twice due to the threats from the Palestinian resistance factions. Now, the march took place indeed last week, but the Zionist settlers suffered many disappointments as it seemed their march was forced to change path for the first time in its history. What happened is that it had to bypass the old city of Al-Quds altogether and not pass by the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This year, however, the Palestinian Unity forced the settlers completely away from the gates of the old city. To discuss this issue with us from the West Bank is Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate. Thank you very much for being with us. Dr. Amal, now individual operations and spontaneous street clashes with the occupation have returned to the forefront in the occupied territories, especially after the flag march organized by the settlers last week, which failed, by the way, for the first time in its history to pass through the old streets of the city of Al-Quds near the Al-Aqsa Mosque. What made this year any different?
Hi, Marwa. Thanks for having me. Of course, that situation during the uprising of May, the escalation that showed the unity of the Palestinians on the ground, and we are talking about Palestinians in historic Palestine. For the first time, all Palestinians in the streets marched in the streets in support of Jerusalem and in support of Gaza. We have to realize that the whole thing started in Jerusalem and the whole thing started in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood and the other neighborhoods surrounding Al-Aqsa Mosque and in Al-Aqsa Mosque itself as well. During the month of Ramadan, they all know that this is a holy month for the Muslims in Jerusalem and in all of Palestine. And constantly the settlers, backed by the political officials head or led by Netanyahu and the police force and the border guards, continuously were inciting the Muslims who were praying in Al-Aqsa Mosque. They burst in Al-Aqsa Mosque several times. They closed the old city gate. They closed the gates of Al-Aqsa. All this rolled down for an overall escalation, which led to the interference or intervention of the Palestinian resistance in Gaza. It wasn't only in Palestine. The whole Arab world was in flames. The whole international community burst into the streets, denouncing and opposing the escalation and the oppression against the Palestinians. So the only thing that they could do is to compromise, whether they want another confrontation with the Palestinian resistance and the popular resistance in the streets of Jerusalem and the streets of Haifa, Yaffa, and the West Bank, or they
But Dr. Amal, the residents, as you said, it all started in Al-Quds, it all started in Sheikh Al-Jarrah, and the residents of Sheikh Al-Jarrah in specific are constantly suffering the aggression and the vulgarity of the illegal colonial settlers who have just one goal. They want to dislocate the people from their houses and steal their houses. What do you think will it take to shut those settlers down and see them at least leave the neighborhood alone?
Actually, it's ethnic cleansing. That's the only term that we can use to describe what the settlers are doing inside Jerusalem, inside the old city, and in the suburbs and the neighborhoods surrounding the old city. This ethnic cleansing actually is a continuous of the ethnic cleansing process that started in 1948 and continued until this day. They want Jerusalem empty. They want to displace the Palestinians from their homes and take them somewhere else so that they can have control over the over Jerusalem, not only the old city, but the whole city. And they want to evacuate Jerusalem from 360,000 Palestinians who are living in Jerusalem and in the surrounding neighborhoods, which cannot happen unless there is a bloodbath there. The Palestinians are confronting the settlers and the officials, the whole regime of apartheid, of the Israeli apartheid, not only in Jerusalem, but all over the Palestine. And they are willing to pay whatever it takes to save and protect their homes and protect their land. They know that this is an existential
issue. Yes, it is an existential issue. And this is exactly what Naftali Bennett, now a new government, is sworn in. It was sworn in at least like 10 days ago. And Naftali Bennett, who's known to be a right-wing Zionist extremist, as the new prime minister for this government, do you expect any changes there in the way that the Zionist regime will deal at least with the rights of the Palestinians to live, to exist in their ancestral home, especially when it comes to political incarceration and to more illegal settlement buildings that Naftali Bennett stands all with?
Well, these governments are the same. They are their roots are stemming from the Zionist ideology, and the Zionist ideology emphasizes one idea, the Jewish state from the Nile to the river. So Bennett, Lapid are no different from Netanyahu. Actually, Bennett used to work in Netanyahu's office, so their goals are the same, their methods are the same, and they, before they were sworn in their parliament, they emphasize that they will continue the settlement process. They will continue evacuating evacuating the neighborhoods in Jerusalem, and they will continue escalating with Gaza and the Palestinian resistance in Gaza. So their program is the same. As we used to say before, there is no difference between the Labor and the Likud, because they are both working according to the Zionist establishment. And it is very well known now that this apartheid regime that was implanted in Palestine has one goal only, is to evacuate the whole area from the Palestinians, which cannot happen. The Palestinians in historic Palestine are exceeding those of the Jewish Israelis, mm-hmm. or
Dr. Amal, something very interesting happened during the past month, which is the resistance in Gaza played a vital role, as you said, in utilizing the unity amongst all Palestinians, all of the native Palestinians on the land in the occupied territories and Gaza were unified in one goal, and which is to save Al-Quds, Al-Aqsa, and to stand with the people of Sheikh Jarrah, for example. And we saw a lot of clashes in the 1948 territories. It was a first for everyone. Bennett already promised a new round of aggression against Gaza. What do you think can the interior Palestinian natives do to at least try and support their families back in Gaza in case this new government decides for a new bloodbath in the Gaza Strip?
As we say, the psychological barrier has been or is no longer there, at least for our brothers and sisters in occupied Palestine 1948. So now if they think that they can take advantage of the situation in Gaza, and they can escalate a new wave of confrontation with the Palestinian resistance, they're gonna lose for sure, because the Palestinians all over are not gonna stay silent. They will barge into the streets, and it's going to be more violent than it was last month. The Palestinians have learned their lesson, have learned that they can, uniting their efforts, they can together defeat Israeli apartheid system plans to wage another war against Gaza. Mm-hmm. They know this fact, and they are ready to confront the police forces, the border guards, the army in the West Bank, the occupied West Bank, to halt their aggression against Gaza. I don't think that they will dare to do another
we hope for, and this is what we look for in order for a liberated Palestine to actually take place in our region once and for all. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Amal Wahdan. You are a human rights advocate from the West Bank for joining us to talk about this matter. Thank you very much for being with us. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about the new president-elect, Ibrahim Raisi of Iran.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The importance of the Iranian presidential elections lies in the fact that it comes in the light of a fierce and unjust war against the Islamic Republic of Iran at all political, economic, cultural, and even social levels. It is so because of Iran's great role in halting the implementation of the Western agenda that was targeting the entire region in order to divide it into rival states that would facilitate the Zionist entity's scheme of achieving its racist terrorist project in West Asia. Now, the massive popular turnout of all sects at the polling stations stifled the mouths of those who harbor spite for the Islamic Republic and its resistance people who suffer the illegal and inhumane Western sanctions put forth to punish nations for their political choice. More details in the following report.
Iran's president-elect Saeed Ibrahim Raisi lauded the historic and passionate turnout in the June 18 election, which he won overwhelmingly, vowing to make good on his campaign pledges and work to form a hard-working, revolutionary, and anti-corruption administration. Iran's presidential election season was the most talked-about event last week amongst Western mainstream media. However, Western officials have been spotted holding two different views of how important that outcome of the presidential race is to the JCPOA nuclear talks. The first view assumes that decision-making in Iran ultimately rests with leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, not the executive branch. Therefore, the change in its elected leadership will not be reflected in Tehran's strategic calculations, and the elections should not be viewed as a strict deadline for a diplomatic breakthrough. Meanwhile, the other view is that whoever sits at the table in complex negotiations matters. Even though the leader of the revolution and his inner circle provide a degree of continuity inside the Iranian system of governance. Therefore, they believe it is better to start and give momentum to the diplomatic process while Rouhani and his team continue to operate, than to start from scratch with a successor. The two arguments, however, need not be contradictory. It might be easier to strike an agreement on JCPOA compliance with the Rouhani administration, but failure to do so would not necessarily close the door to his successor seeking a similar agreement. The outlines of the nuclear negotiations will become more clear through the idea of compliance for compliance, with the terms of the JCPOA that was agreed upon with the P5+1 in 2015. This means that the U.S. would have to lift the economic sanctions imposed on the Islamic Republic. On the part of Iran, it would include reducing uranium enrichment activities and getting rid of any new stockpiles. But will the U.S. comply? It is hard to predict, especially that the leader of the revolution made it clear that Iran will not comply unless all U.S. economic sanctions against the Islamic Republic are completely lifted.
To discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Mr. Mustafa Khosh Sheshman, which is an Iranian affairs analyst with us from Tehran. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Mustafa. Now, if you want to highlight the importance of the Iranian presidential elections in its 13th session that happened last week, then we must address this issue from all its
aspects, specifically the regional and the international ones as well. Do you think that the election of President Ebrahim Raisi will bring about changes to both the regional and the international levels in dealing with the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Hello, and thanks for having me. Well, yes, as a matter of fact, after 8 years of President Hassan Rouhani's detente with the United States, we expected that Iranians would go for the opposite camp. This has been happening since several decades ago. When Hashemi Rafsanjani was in office, Nader Nuri was the establishment's candidate, or was believed to be the establishment's candidate. But people voted for Khatami, and after 8 years of Khatami, people voted for his critic, who was not really well known, Ahmadinejad. And after 8 years of Ahmadinejad, they voted for Hassan Rouhani, that was not known to the public, but he was supported by Hashemi, standing in opposition to Ahmadinejad. Therefore, this time after 8 years, we expected that Raisi would be elected, or somebody from the revolutionary camp. They have a different agenda, actually. It doesn't mean that they are going to, you know, be on the offensive, but they are powerful, and of course, being logical is another feature of their decision makings, especially in foreign policy. When it comes home, they rely very much on industrious work, on domestic capabilities, and activating domestic economic potentials. Therefore, we do sincerely believe that we should expect a move, a giant progress in domestic economy, as well as expansion of ties with the regional states, the neighboring states, and also when it comes to foreign policy, there will be a major shift towards the whole world, and it's not just the United States. This doesn't mean that the nuclear deal would be discarded, but it means that all the world states that did not receive much attention under Rouhani or in the past 1 year, from now on.
We will talk in depth a bit about the JCPOA, but first I want to ask you about the religious sovereignty of the people inside of Iran, and which includes the unified presence of the people and the serious competition in addition to the Islamic standards of the Islamic Republic. It's a mixture that continues to face scrutiny and a lot of criticism and disbelief by various Western regimes. And that's obviously the same thing that has been happening since 1979, since the revolution up until today. However, how does the Iranian population, especially the youth of Iran, view these constant Western attempts of trying to dominate their country, their sovereignty like this?
Well, they've come to learn a lot. I've been saying that if it hadn't been for the U.S. hostility, maybe the younger generation would have not been acquainted enough with the principles of Islamic revolution and with its cause and ideals. After especially developments in the last decade in the United States, after Donald Trump took office, and after the latest round of election in the U.S., the U.S. is no more in a position to preach other nations about democracy and human rights, especially after those confessions that Donald Trump made, and after the worst of brutal a way of dealing with the protesters in the streets in the U.S. capital in Washington that continues even now today, Iranian public, especially the youth, have learned a lot.
We always hear the same words on Western mainstream media, like rigged elections, hardliners, or maybe fundamentalists. There are just few words that are used by the Western mainstream media. How is it hard for the Western public to view these serious news analysis that pass on Western mainstream media as actually pure propaganda against anyone who at least just have a different mindset of that of the United States of America?
Well, until 2 decades ago, it was really hard for the Americans to realize the realities because they lived in a glass house of the campaign. The information dissemination was done in a one-way road from the United States to abroad, while they never allowed others especially the alternative media like Press TV, Russia Today, CGTN, Al Jazeera, and others, to do, to be free when it came to some certain topics dealing with what the United States didn't like. As a matter of fact, after we entered this millennium in the last two decades, with the expansion of use of social media applications, this barrier is being removed.
Mm-hmm.
More and more people are learning about the realities on the ground. And although the United States continues to impose its hegemonic rule over the media in order to establish its own narrative of developments, in many cases, false narrative,
mm-hmm.
Still, Americans are learning. In the last war in Gaza, you saw that many Americans took to the streets in the United States as well as Canada and many capitals in Europe because they have come to realize and sense the reality gradually. They are, I do believe that they are, learning more about the facts on the ground through these social media platforms.
Well, this brings us to the upcoming JCPOA talks, if that's going to continue. That is, in his first speech as president, President Ibrahim Raisi said that he will be pledging to remove the U.S. sanctions to try and relieve the Iranian nation from these illegal economic sanctions. How do you see the JCPOA's future with such a statement on day one by the new president?
If the JCPOA is revived under President Rouhani, then it would be respected by President Raisi. Let's remember that it's the establishment that decides for macro-scale strategies, but the Iranian supreme leader, he is in the habit of giving free hand to all the governments. The same way he said he was pessimistic, but he gave the permission to Rouhani to go and deal with the United States through the JCPOA. If Raisi asks for a different road, then he would be allowed to do so. He has a complicated plan if the nuclear deal is not revived under President Rouhani. This doesn't mean that negotiations would be cut off, but it would mean that it wouldn't be as important as it was as a tool in diplomacy, a diplomatic tool, under President Rouhani, because
mm-hmm.
it was just negotiations under Rouhani. But now under Raisi, it's a more complicated issue. If the negotiation will be underway, but not as important as before. Then a second step that goes in parallel is diffusing the U.S. sanctions through developing domestic economic potentials, expanding ties with the regional states, and also becoming a member of the global economic projects like the One Belt, One Road initiative of the Chinese,
mm-hmm.
the South-North Corridor or Indo-Eurasian Corridor, and also at the same time, Iran would go to, increase the leverage on the United States, not just through the nuclear capabilities or the military capabilities, but Iran has a wide array of options to increase the pressures.
I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mustafa Khosheshm, for being with us. You are an Iranian affairs analyst with us from Tehran to discuss what are the prospects of the regional and international relations that are going to be tied again with the Islamic Republic of Iran after the election of the new president. Thank you very much for being with us. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This
is back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of Back to Reality. In the studio with me, I have two special guests and friends. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, sister.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. I am Sister Nasreen, and I'm happy to be here.
Thank you so very much, Sister Nasreen. Though your accent makes it quite obvious, just for, you know, our listeners to get more in tune with the vibe of our discussion. Can I ask where you're from and what you've your studies have been?
I'm born in England, and I am studying Masters in Philosophy of Ethics.
MashaAllah. Thank you so
Applied
very
ethics,
much.
Actually.
Thank you so much for that information. And my other lovely guest is...
Assalamu alaikum, dear sister. I'm Muzaffar Haider from the UK. I'm studying here in the holy city of Qom, studying Islam. And I'm at your service today.
Thank you so very much for joining us, Brother Muzaffar, Sister Nasreen. It's an absolute pleasure and honor. Today we're going to be talking about how or whether media, especially social media, makes us stupid.
Stupid?
Yeah. Does it?
Does it?
Yeah, that's like clean cut, straightforward, no fuss, no muss, no bush. Does social media make us stupid? Y'all are nodding.
But does it doesn't matter, you know, right
now.
Well,
it's interesting because there's a vast amount of information. You can learn so many things about
really?
The world. Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
first
sure.
Let's
yeah.
define social media.
Okay, social media is technology which is used to share images, words, and video.
Mm-hmm.
In a nutshell, right? That's
all
pretty
right.
much what it is.
Yeah.
It allows people from all over the world to get connected. Wherever they are, to others, and to share their messages.
All right, that's social media.
Technically, if you look at it just objectively, it should be a miraculous thing that
it
allows
should.
The world to be
exactly,
a better place.
Exactly, because when you define it that way, I'm like, then what are we doing wrong?
What are we
well,
doing
who
wrong?
Says we're doing something wrong?
Ah, even better.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean? What are we
yeah,
doing
Yeah, I thought
right?
that was the question was that to analyze it, not necessarily taking sides. But is it a negative thing?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just like, what are you using a gun for? Right? And that is just the same as anything that is neutral,
mm-hmm.
that is put in the hand of an idiot. If you give $1 billion to an idiot, he will spend
Loyal.
It also in an idiotic way. But if you put it in someone who has a little bit of conscience and intelligence, then he can make a miracle happen on earth, right?
Mm.
Literally, immobilize positive things. And that is the same as the social media, that if we are living in a way that is correct or sensible or intelligent or towards the right goal, then social media is just an assistant.
Okay, then let me ask this very blunt, borderline rude question. Is social media in the hands of idiots?
Yes.
Which you answered even more boldly.
Absolutely. The world is full of idiots, isn't it, unfortunately. I mean, I was told never to say comments like that because it makes me sound pretentious. But my God, like, I'm not saying I'm the most intelligent
person
on earth.
No, we have to be honest. And if that's the truth, then we can also defend ourselves with evidence.
Hmm.
Best
that
example
one.
Is when a certain president in the world announced that bleach heals coronavirus, and people actually went out and drank it and died because of it. You know?
Do you remember the thing era, the Tide Pod era, that they would eat Tide Pods?
Oh yeah, there you go.
Do you remember the Flat Earther era?
It's still going on. Actually,
it's an ongoing era.
Flat
Earthers.
Oh, the Flat Earth.
Yeah.
Some of their arguments are quite convincing, by the way.
That's the point.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The point was not the flat earth. The point was, does the defense of the opposite
mm-hmm.
have enough argument? You know?
I think pictures
it means
from space
w-
does
we
it for me.
But no, that highlights a great thing. Like, have you seen all these internet challenges? One of them was to lick a toilet challenge.
Yeah.
One of them was to... Just ice bucket challenge and things like that. And
invade your pet's
I think, do you know what has happened?
Wait, no, I need to finish a sentence, otherwise it sounds weird. Invade your pet's space era, you know, that challenge?
No.
Like, you have a dog or a cat and just invade their personal space, go snuggle with them, go sleep in their bed, go, like, shove your foot in their face and see how their reaction is.
Social media has made this machine where it is a competition to see who can be the most idiotic.
Yes.
And what
are they trying to gain from that?
Yes.
Fame, money, a lot of
likes,
money,
attention.
It's the Bart Simpson. It's the dumbing down of society to satisfy the agenda of those at the top.
And
what
we've seen happen over the last few years is a saturation of the social media to the point where all the dumbness has floated to the surface. A lot of the intellectual discussions have been hidden away behind algorithms. They're not as fancy anymore. They're not as interesting to watch. And so
they're not as viral.
They're not as viral. I mean,
why would viral culture, I think, really did very little good for humanity.
How many times does the Quran actually say, "Aktharuhum la ya'lamun"? Most of them don't know. And this is like the kind of bleak description of the majority of human beings throughout the Quran. And I think it's time we start to believe in the Quran. It is telling us and warning us that people, generally speaking, are just completely, they lack knowledge, they're ignorant.
Mm.
And I think a lot of that is coming to the surface now. And
definitely. We'll be back after a short break, so stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Everything else in this age of media is coming to the surface. You can't have especially when you're a famous personality, sneeze without like it making the front line of every social media the next day. Their excuse for displaying so much hollow, shallow, stupid, idiotic content is that, oh, but the world is so broken and so bitter. Oh, people are going through so much hardship. Let's have some like comical relief. Let's just have a good time where we're here. And they come up with this stupidity, this blatant stupidity, with the excuse of let's make each other laugh.
Those are people that should have nothing to do with our type of thinking and lifestyle. I don't even know of what goes on in there, and neither my children, because that is the riffraff of the human race. Why do we involve ourselves in their media at all? You know, we should be sort of going after, having a motive and a sort of and is a reason to be on the social media and fulfilling that purpose. Not that these I'm assuming they're actors or, you know, Hollywood or some kind of people that you're talking about, but they have nothing to do with us. There is a line between us and them.
The line is being blurred to a greater or lesser extent. And
which is sad.
It's gotten to a point where, I don't know if you've noticed, but occasionally an old video from like the 60s and 70s and 80s would pop
when you
up.
Said old, my mind directly went to the 2000s. That old, like 68.
Even
Stone
then,
age
even
old,
then.
Okay.
But it will be somebody just speaking intellectually. It might be a comedian. It might be an actor. It might be anybody, a politician. But the way they will talk, and you'll scroll down and you'll see in the comments, why can't our people talk like this anymore?
Mm.
It's laughable, but at the same time, it's quite scary.
It is.
Because if you look at the next generation, we're millennials, right? We're kind of in the millennial generation. Generation Z, though, the next generation, oh my God. Have you ever gauged their sense of humor? So you don't really like kids, do you, sister? But
no.
If you try and gauge and just look at the kind of content that they're, the kind of Minecraft TikTok kids, right?
Yeah.
Their attention span, like I thought my attention span was hurt. Their attention span is like, oh, I'm honestly really scared.
But that really does.
That's frightening.
It is frightening, but also studies have shown that engaging excessively in social media really does rewire our brains to become less focused, more easily distracted. We